and fruit bats.
And good morning and welcome to An Unbalanced Breakfast here on WMFO Medford 91.5 FM, streaming live on WMFO.org. We are back after a week off, as we've been doing every other weekend here in the summer. Kathleen, how are you?
Hey, I'm good. I finished my internship this week, so I'm free!
Very exciting. And as you corrected me this morning, you got 2 more years to go here at Tufts.
Yeah.
So very cool. All right, so people, if our listeners know the drill, so we are here for an hour of nutrition and fitness and food talk. If you want to call in, the numbers here are 855-915-WMFO. That's 855-915-9636. Or you can call in at 781-350-3264. And you may want to call in today because we have a very special guest on the phone with us this morning. Hello, Eve. Are you there?
I am.
Hello, so we have Eve Turtle-Paul here on the phone. Thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Of course, thanks for having me.
Thank you. So real quick, for those who don't know, Eve is the author of A Taste of Generation Yum, How the Millennial Generation's Love for Organic Fare, Celebrity Chefs, and Microbrews Will Make or Break the Future of Food. And that book investigates the driving forces behind the millennial generation's obsession with food. Eve is also the millennial expert in residence for Group SJR, which is a part of Hill Knowlton Strategies. She's worked for the New York Times, as well as working with Mark Bittman, and her publications or her writing has appeared in publications like the Chicago Tribune, Plate, The Village Voice, The Atlantic, Refinery 29, Huffington Post, and Medium, of course, as one of her pieces we'll be discussing this morning. But again, thank you very much for taking time out of your schedule to call in, Eve.
Yeah, of course. Bright and early. It's just an excuse to get my day going.
Exactly. Yeah, perfect. So I was wondering if you could just kind of start off talking generally about some of the projects you're working on, such as your position with Group SJR, sort of what you do for them and some of the work you've been doing.
Sure. Yeah. So SJR actually was part of my previous life. Before this book took off, I was working in content marketing, and they were the company that I was working for. Really, when I went to quit, the CEO of that company had just about the best reaction possible, which was, well, how can we support you in what you're doing next? And I think, you know, he saw an opportunity, which is that I provide, you know, an expertise in terms of their clients as well. So I just every so often help them out on different things when I can be of use. So they do writing for brands, websites, social media, things like that. And really what my expertise is now is how to connect with young people. And not necessarily just how to connect with them, but what do they need in terms of psychological well-being? Really, my investigation into food ended up being more of a sociological, psychological review of the generation. More than anything else. So I just put that to use when I can.
Yeah, that's great. And how did you first become interested in millennials and younger generations, both from, well, you said it became more of a sociological aspect too, but also just from food. How did this all start? How did it come about?
Well, I have a very millennial history myself, which is a bit of a hodgepodge of different things. So I did my undergrad at Amherst College and did that in psych. Really loved psychology, thought that I wanted to get my PhD in psych, and then worked in a lab for the summer right after I graduated, and saw that there were people doing incredibly fascinating things that would get written up and put in an academic journal, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked to one of the grad students about it, and he was like, well, that's why we need other people to tell stories with it. And that kind of just, like, I don't know, flipped a switch for me, but it was the recession, 2009. I didn't have a job. So me being me, I moved to Argentina to live on the Argentine peso and found a position working at an expat newspaper in Buenos Aires, and quickly found that food was one of the best ways to learn about that culture. Because Argentina, I don't know if you know anything about it, but it's really complicated, especially with their recent political history, but also religious history. And I found that food, writing about it, was the best window for me into policy, religion, culture, agriculture, economics, all of it. And when I got home, I started working for the Economic Policy Institute. I'm giving you my whole resume, but I promise this is all relevant. I started working for the Economic Policy Institute. Again, peak of the recession, I was helping communicate on unemployment and underemployment, but also at the time they were writing reports basically just about how screwed millennials are in terms of income. And at the same time, I kept writing about food for NPR. And so all of these various things, the psychology, the interest in food culture, my understanding of the economic situation for this generation, kind of all collided at a certain point in time when I looked up and just thought, why are young people today spending their discretionary income on food when we can't afford to pay rent a lot of the time? Mm-hmm. We're still living in our parents' basements, but we're, you know, ramen now is, it's not like the 17-cent packet, it's the $17 bowl.
Right.
And I just found it fascinating from all of those different angles, kind of reaching from everything in my history.
Great. And I know you said you joked that you're just giving your whole resume, and a lot of this stuff is in your book as well, Taste of Generation Yum, that we definitely recommend here that people check out. So kind of at this point, what are your ultimate goals with the research that you're doing? Is it, you know, is it food-centric? Is it helping the generation? Is it helping the companies that you've been working with? What are your goals?
Yeah, good question. And I spent a lot of time thinking about that myself. And I think that I'm in a really special position at this point because the goals of companies and the goals of the general public are actually starting to align. And what I mean is that this generation is demanding very certain specific things from food companies. I was reading an article actually in the Wall Street Journal. I don't know if you guys have talked about it on the show, but the Wall Street Journal came out with an article about a week ago that's about basically the call for simplification in ingredients. And one of the comments is that this is the biggest shift we've seen in food since World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And the result is, right, young people saying, I want organic. I don't want pesticides in my food. I want to understand what it is that I'm eating. I don't want to get obesity. I don't want to be obese. I don't want to get diabetes. I don't want my kids to be inflicted with that. There's something needs to change. But you have this, and an engaged population also, right, that's cooking or watching cooking shows or gardening. You know, edible seed sales for gardening are highest among the millennial generation, which is pretty amazing considering most of us don't even own our own houses.
Mm-hmm.
So all of that comes together. And then at the same time, right, companies are starting to realize that business as usual is just not going to float.
Sure.
And that I think a lot of them are realizing they won't continue to be in business if they don't react. But I also think that a lot of these messages around sustainability are kind of forcing them to deal with their own kind of, you know, evils in the closet, so to speak, which is that, you know, a lot of these companies have been dealing with shortages of certain crops due to climate change, you know, or a plethora of or food waste because of distribution systems that aren't quite right, or, you know, a lot of different aspects. And now they're actually interested in making change. And, you know, some are more interested than others.
Right.
Some are interested in doing it at face value, but there really are some big guys out there that are implementing a philosophical shift. So I guess at the answer to your question is that I'm working to create a better food future for this generation and the generations to come. And part of the way to do that is by helping the largest companies in the world and the small guys,
mm-hmm.
Better meet the needs of this generation.
Good. And so you think that there is some optimism too, then, that these companies aren't, it's not simply just reacting to their customer base in order to make money, but that there will be some positive long-term sustainable changes that they're making as well?
Well, okay, so this is the beautiful thing about sustainability, right? It's like the biggest cost is up front, and then once you implement mm-hmm. it, it's going to be cost savings for the most part. So there really wouldn't be a business reason to backtrack on it. But the other thing is that I kind of look at everything through a pessimistic lens. I understand business is business. They need to be meeting their bottom lines. And, you know, at the end of the day, whether they're doing it to keep customers or just to keep customers or whether they're doing it because they're being altruistic, it doesn't really matter as long as the consumer base continues to demand positive changes for themselves and for the environment.
Okay. Very cool. All right. So now to kind of take a deeper dive into some of the things that are written, and you're still writing, right? I know that you just recently had a piece published in Forbes.
Yeah. So I just started, last week, I guess, I started a column for Forbes.
Okay.
You guys can follow along. I will be highlighting millennial entrepreneurs in the food space. So very specific, and also with a slight focus on female entrepreneurs as well. I think Forbes is, they have a whole subsection, Women at Forbes. It's about empowering female entrepreneurs. And it's actually, it's surprising in the food space. A lot of the people there are men. So it's an exciting opportunity to just do interviews and also just do reviews of like what are the hot things going on right now. I'm working on a piece on insects and you know the latest companies around insect protein and we have you know a bunch of fun stuff coming up.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, I didn't realize that was a regular column, so definitely looking forward to that. And now I'm going to turn it over to Kathleen because it's actually funny, this interview is kind of a long time in the making because we had first after your column or your piece on Medium called How Millennials Fake the Food Movement was published. We were trying to get something set up and finally have it going. So very happy about that. And Kathleen was actually the first one that reached out to you. She wasn't hosting the show at that point, but we're still going to have you on. And now she is hosting the show. So she is here. And she, we just had a couple kind of specific questions about your book, Taste of Generation Yum, as well as your Medium column. So I'll turn it over to Kathleen to ask her questions.
Yeah. So, the way this came about, I read your article and it got me kind of fired up. So I hope you don't mind if I push back on you a little bit. But you know, as a millennial myself, I do a lot of reading about millennials and thinking about my place in society as a millennial. And in reading your, and please don't take this in any the wrong way at all, but in reading some of the things that you have written both in Generation Yum and your Medium piece and in other places, I'm not sure if I believe that you believe what you're touting about what we think about food and how we, I mean, I do think that we use it as social currency, but I think that it goes deeper than that. And I don't know. Maybe I'll just let you respond to that initially.
Well, actually, can you explain just a little bit more about what you mean?
Well, you talk a lot in Generation Yum about people who spend, you know, what pennies they make on really expensive meals at like French Laundry. $270 is one figure that you quoted from somebody in that book.
Yep.
And I'm sitting there like reading all of these examples and thinking like, well, maybe you're talking about millennials, but I don't think you're talking about my kind of millennial. Like I think to me, you're talking about foodies, and I have a hard time conflating foodies and millennials.
Okay. That's really interesting. So I guess I can tell you about my journey since I wrote the book. And I think that the Medium article was a little bit more on point with where I am. And so I think you're making a very good point. So first of all, I've come to realize that millennial itself is kind of a ridiculous term, right? Because it's lumping in 83 million people just in, you know. And so it's what I've come to learn is that millennial is more than anything a mindset. And it's a value system.
Okay.
And that people in and outside the generation can hold that value system. And that at the end of the day, what my research really was focusing around what, and this is really the contention point, I think, because and we've talked about this a little bit. There are a certain number of millennials who are super passionate about the food system.
Yeah.
Right? Like you're looking around, you're seeing the problems with what's happening in the environment, with human health, and this is your passion, and you want to solve it. Now, there is an amazing community forming around that. And that is literally the reason why I have hope for this generation and for the generations after it, is this amazing group of people that are working on these issues. But that is still not the vast majority of the people who are participating in food. And the vast majority of the people who are participating in food are not doing it for altruistic reasons. They are doing it for self-soothing reasons. They're doing it to make themselves feel better. And sometimes it happens to be making the sustainable choice, but that's not driven by altruism. It's driven by a need to make themselves feel better. And
go ahead.
What I'm finding is that this directly correlates with technology and the influence of technology within our own lives, and the fact that it, and I have a lot of this in the book, but that it causes, for the most part, higher rates of loneliness, of depression, of anxiety. Mm-hmm. There is a constant need to brand yourself. There's a constant comparison. There is also this idea of, you know, you think of something that you think is really unique and special, and you go online and Google it, and like 1,800 people have already thought of it around the world.
Mm-hmm.
Right. We're also bombarded, I think, especially in the last few months, man. It's this 24-hour news system has just been exhausting and unbelievably depressing. And people are soothing themselves through food. And I don't think that that's a bad thing. I think that it is a welcome opportunity, and it honestly provides an open door for all those other people who are trying to change the food system, because there is now an audience that is open to it.
Right. And
you
that's
know, like something. Yeah, go ahead.
That's what I was going to ask you next is, you know, maybe we are really self-indulgent and narcissistic and care about personal branding more than any other generations before us, but I'm kind of like, so what? Like, if this results in conversations like the one we're having right now,
right.
If it encourages millennials to get out the vote around food issues,
right.
If we're supporting local farms and food businesses, I kind of feel like the end justifies the means. Like, I don't really care if other people feel narcissistic about their food, as long as something's getting done. And I think this is an opportunity for people like us who do care about food system
right.
inequities and farm subsidies and other things that happen in the food system. I think it's a chance for us to capitalize on food being sexy.
Yeah.
To make policy sexy.
I agree 100%. And that's so, you know, Matt was asking, what's my goal? Better food system for all. Yes. Okay. The other part of my goal, personally, is to make food policy sexy for all. But the way to do that, and you and I have talked about this a little bit via email,
mm-hmm.
what's really important, and this is, again, from the individual to a Fortune 100 company, is that in order to communicate properly, in order to be most effective, you need to understand the psychology of the people you're trying to reach.
Okay.
And you can... there's multiple ways to approach an issue that's going to change how responsive people are to it. And if you understand that most foodies are not inherently as passionate about food policy as you are, then you need to come at these issues from an angle that's going to get them excited and that's going to feed their need for control and soothing and sensory stimulation and community.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. And that's a fair criticism, I think, of kind of the way I've been approaching it. But yeah, I wanted to also ask you, go ahead.
I just want to give you one example. So the
okay.
only time that I've ever been right at predicting the future was at the end of my book. And it was... I've been studying, right, more of, like, the social currency aspect of food,
mm-hmm.
and I hadn't been as interested in the food policy part. And then by the four years of doing research and writing, by the end of it, I was more interested in the food policy part. And I think probably didn't even spend enough time in the book on that, but wove it in at the end, and then really thought about, well, so there is this division between the food movement and foodies.
Mm-hmm.
How do you get foodies interested? And I thought about all the things that I'd learned along the way and the millennial need to perform and brand themselves. And I said, I say in the book that I think food waste is going to be the number one issue that people can gather around.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because you can create a recipe for carrot top pesto or pickled, pineapple rind or whatever it's going to be, and take a picture and put it on Instagram or put it on Pinterest and gloat about it.
Mm-hmm.
And you can form a community around it, mm-hmm. right? Like, what have you done this week to limit your food waste or live more sustainably? And at the time when I wrote that, even a year ago, no one was talking about food waste. And now it's like on the cover of National Geographic. You can have like a food waste salad at Sweetgreen. And I do think it's because of the food policy issue that plays into those other wants and needs of the general population.
Definitely. Yeah, we're definitely seeing increased interest in food waste and a means of making that part of our personal brand while also making change, which I think is a...
Right. Which is the key.
Good thing, yeah. If I could turn the conversation a little bit, I read your Thursday Forbes piece that you just published on August 11th about women in farming. I really... I'm really interested in women in farming, so I was glad to see that. But you quoted Anna Rachel Terman. She was actually talking to Civil Eats at the time. But women in ag are especially interested in environment, health, food, nutrition, and how farm and community are connected. That's a paraphrase of what she said. But it occurred to me that those interests aren't necessarily millennial concerns or even foodie concerns. But I wonder if, like, what if the rise that we see happening in food becoming sexy is because women are coming into their own in farming? Like, at the risk of overgeneralizing my own sex, and I hate to do that, but, health and food and nutrition and community, all of those things kind of fall under the traditional purview of women's work.
Yeah.
And I feel really like a weird feminist right now talking about stereotypes. Women have long been looked to as nurturers. And I wonder if we're seeing some of this shift happen because we no longer view ourselves as wives or daughters of farmers, like you said, but as farmers, we're self, and we're redefining the way we relate to food. What do you think about that?
I think part of this is about feminism. It's about female empowerment. It's about the fact that if we see a problem, we're going to go out and try to do something about it ourselves. We're not going to stay at home. Well, I mean, some women are staying at home with the kids, which there's nothing wrong with.
Right.
But even stay-at-home moms are doing stuff online about organizing communities. Like, there's still so much that you can do because of the internet.
Definitely.
Or you can have your own vegetable garden in the backyard and be teaching your kids about composting and gardening and all of these different things. So, it would be really interesting to do like a more in-depth study about female empowerment over the last decade as it relates to food systems. I mean, I don't think that that exists.
Yeah, I think that'd be really interesting too. I think you should write another book and then come back for another interview.
I'm going to think about that.
Okay.
But I think what's really interesting is, so like being a farmer before, and this is a few of the farmers that I interviewed in my book, like, because they started farming at least 5, 6, 7 years ago. And when they went to their parents, And one of them is Annie Meyer, who's a farmer. Actually, now she's set up a whole distribution system for farms. She's doing amazing stuff. I'm going to write about her for Forbes, too, as, like, an update. But her parents were like, that's, like, for men. Like, that, like, mm-hmm. This is clearly, like, a stepping stone in your career to food policy or something bigger. And the reality is, and she was really the first person to say this to me, which is that, like, farming is not man labor. I mean, part of it is like lifting heavy things and driving big trucks, but so much of it is so much more intellectually challenging than anyone gives credit to. And also viscerally pleasurable in like the, this is what makes us human, connecting with the land and plants and watching cell division happen is pretty astounding. And I think that that idea of a farmer is shifting in society, which is really spectacular, which is that you don't need to be, you know, a 6'5", you know, bulky man in order to do this work, that you need serious brain power. And the issues, as you know, you mentioned about nutrition and health and climate change, soil, carbon sequestration, whatever it's going to be. I think because people are talking about farming in a broader view, it's engaging more people.
Definitely. Yeah, I would agree with that. The more I learn about agriculture and farming, I definitely have greater respect for farmers, both male and female, about the science of what they do, and a very deep, intimate understanding of the land that they work, which is very often location-based, too. So,
right.
Yeah.
But like, when you get into permaculture farming, it's really complicated.
Yeah.
You know, I think that most of the idea that we think of is monoculture, mm-hmm. right? So the farmer that's like planting the same thing over and over and spraying and planting and spraying and planting. But there's a resurgence in agriculture that's not that. And in order to deal with land properly, the way that it's supposed to be dealt with, it's really complicated.
Mm-hmm. Yep, definitely. Changing the subject again a little bit, do you think that your research has changed the way that you look at and interact with social media?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
So the bragging point was actually brought up by Anthony Bourdain, who I had the chance to interview, which still remains one of the coolest moments in my history as a journalist.
Oh, I bet.
I like, almost peed myself. I just think that he's a spectacular journalist, and by the way, he speaks in complete full sentences.
Ooh.
Which makes it really easy to transcribe, but he is
yes.
a very intelligent man, and a really deep thinker, and we were talking about you know, exactly the topic of millennials and food, and he, you know, we started talking about social media, and he brought up the point that he feels weird now when he's Instagramming or whatever it is, a meal that he's having, because on the one hand, he knows that it's about engaging his audience, right, and living vicariously in some way, or getting them excited or want to watch the show.
Mm-hmm.
But that, on another hand, he used expletives that I won't use here, but you know, he was saying, you know, like, hey, you whatever, like, I'm having this amazing meal and you're at home having cereal. And,
right.
you know, and it really was this moment that was really uncomfortable for me. And after we got off that call, I went and looked through my own like Instagram and Facebook feed and thought, like, what was I trying to say to people with each of those posts?
Interesting.
And you know, quickly realized that, yeah, okay, some of it's about like sharing a special moment with friends and family who aren't near you, right? But the vast majority of what we do online is, in essence, social bragging.
Sure.
And yeah, I mean, I'm more aware of it now. I'm very aware that I'm trying to build my brand, because again, like, I want a larger community to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
As a journalist, I need input from other people like yourself who are going to push me and engage in conversations. So I am hyper aware of that now, but I think it's really uncomfortable actually to look through your social media history and think like, what was I really trying to say to people? What was I trying to prove? Was I trying to prove that I have money? Was I trying to prove that my life's great and I have a boyfriend that loves me?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, and pictures of food, they communicate all of that.
Right.
You know, and that's the other part of it, is like, it's not just a plate of pasta. That plate of pasta has a context to it. You know, was it made with organic ingredients? Was it made for a special romantic evening? Or it's just saying, I have the time to cook, which is sadly of itself kind of an elitist thing now.
Right, definitely. Yeah, it's interesting how we tell stories about ourselves using food.
Right, right, precisely.
All right, and so we were going to take a break initially, but since we have you for about 10 more minutes, Eve, so if we're actually, if it's all right with you, just kind of keep plowing through here.
Sure, yeah.
So So yeah, anybody listening, definitely check out Eve's her book, A Taste of Generation Yum, which you can download, or you can have multiple download options at her website, eveturopaul.com. Also follow Eve on Twitter at eveturopaul, and check out her column on Forbes. And now, kind of switching gears again a bit to the election, because this has been obviously a very hot topic generally throughout the country and the world. But also, we spoke 2 weeks ago on the show, our last episode, about food policy and the election and just in general, in terms of federal and local state policy, one of the concerns people have been voicing is how little food policy there appears to be in the major party platforms, or even the third party platforms. So Eve, you actually got to go to the Democratic National Convention, correct?
I did, yeah.
So can you talk about what that was like, and then kind of from there about kind of what you, kind of your thoughts on food policy in the election and what you would like to see?
Yeah. Well, so the DNC was a gift from a friend who had an extra ticket. So it wasn't necessarily work-related. It was just kind of like life experience-related.
Yeah.
It was spectacular. I mean, I'm anti-Trump to the utmost degree. I wouldn't say that I'm anti-Republican, but it was a really special moment for a variety of reasons. The feeling within the conference was one of general love. There really were people of all different backgrounds coming together, and I don't think that I even realized how much it would impact me seeing like the fact that it was the first woman to be nominated for president. But I really felt it in that room. Again, food was not a topic, and I found it also I still do kind of live in a little bit of a bubble, because I'm thinking about food all the time and I'm thinking about food policy all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And even within the convention center, the lines for food were like an hour and a half long because they didn't have enough of it, and pretty much the only options were things that were highly processed or fried. There were a couple stands that had salads, and interestingly, those were the ones with the longest lines, because I do think that people are trying to eat better.
Mm-hmm.
It was all about like a healthy America and stuff, and now you're putting all these people here in a position where they have to have like fried hoagies. there's only so many things that the DNC can think about, and I understand that. But it didn't, that experience really had nothing to do with food, because it hasn't been a part of the conversation. And the person who had the greatest platform on it was Bernie Sanders. I'm sure that the Sanders campaign website is probably still up. So if anyone's curious and looking at it, he has, really comprehensive information there about, helping new farmers, but also about the SNAP program and farm subsidies. And Clinton does have some of it. She is definitely interested in supporting new farmers. She's obviously super passionate about childhood nutrition. But you wouldn't know that unless you did a like intensive search. And that's what I find frustrating on multiple levels, because it kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier, which is like people care about food, and there's a lot of talk about gun policy, and I agree with it, and I think it's incredibly important.
Mm-hmm.
But you look at the number one killer in the U.S. It's not guns; it's heart disease.
Yeah.
It's obesity-related diseases. And to me, the fact that the presidential nominees are not talking about the number one thing that kills people in this country is astounding.
Definitely.
And actually, it's funny, you mentioned about trying to find the different candidates food policies. We actually used your piece from the Huffington Post on one of the first episodes of the show. We did like a little quiz at the end about where each, this was back during the primaries, about where everybody stood. So it was kind of like, oh, what is, who, you know, who said this about SNAP?
Yeah.
It was actually funny at the time. We said, oh, what did, you know, we had Trump as one of the answers. They're like, well, you won't have to worry about that food policy or non-food policy. And now here we are. So I'm kind of wondering, just in your opinion, what, because it seems like obviously everything for a president or a presidential candidate is kind of a balancing act, but especially with food, because it's so deep, because you mentioned the nutrition aspect, but then you have so many different regions of the country with agriculture or just their own cultures in terms of food. You have things crossing partisan lines, like we've talked a couple of times about Alaska. So, you know, there's people think of the GMO crops, and then you have now the GMO salmon, and Alaska is very anti-GMO salmon because salmon is part of their state economy. So you have all these little things to balance, and then of course you have the farm bill. So what could I don't know if you would, you may not have the ideal platform, but so what do you think the best approach could be for a federal policy platform, and or some of the key concepts that people should tackle?
Yeah, I mean, without going into too much detail, I feel like there needs to be an open conversation about making real food more affordable, about encouraging companies through some kind of, maybe it's kind of like a backhanded push towards working with rotational crops to better the soil. I mean, there's some, again, like crossing partisan lines, I've met with farmers who are very much not Democrats, but these are the things they care about. They care about feeding hungry kids, and they care about maintaining their farmland so that they can continue passing it down for generations. And they understand that water and soil degradation are massive issues. So it's kind of like, what can you talk about that's not going to offend people? Oh, we need to be able to feed all of our kids healthy and nutritious things so that they can perform better in school, they can live healthier lives. Oh, and by the way, we're also going to end up reducing our healthcare costs if we have less people dealing with obesity and diabetes. You know, we need to incentivize programs that are about, you know, utilizing rotational crops so that farmers can be growing organically and still making enough money, right? Mm-hmm. And how do you do that? You get Tostitos to use, you know, barley. or some other kind of rotational grain and provide a set income for that farmer. You know, there are some basic issues that I believe would resonate among most people. And I think it's also about not vilifying those who are obese or diabetic or in those communities, because for a large part, it's not really their fault.
Right.
Right. There's a huge lack of food education in this country, but there's also, I mean, if you are living on SNAP, the vast majority of what you can afford is going to be processed high in sugar, salt, and fat.
Mm-hmm.
And you're probably going to be working multiple jobs and don't have time to cook a real meal. So, you know, I think that if you start this conversation without, and do it in a way that's not about, oh, well, you should be exercising more, or, well, you should know better, but saying there are companies and systems in place right now that is partially due to policy, and I want to work to fix that, I believe that that would be a platform that would resonate among a great deal of voters.
But maybe not corporations who have vested interests.
Well, ding, ding,
in preserving the system.
Exactly.
Well, but okay, so, but here's, and this will be, I guess, my final comment, because I do need to run.
Sure.
But and this is part of the work that I'm doing with these other companies, which is that, you know, how do you get to the point within that company to realize that your money would be better spent lobbying for organic than for sugar? And I think that they are getting to that point. You know, I've had conversations where different brand teams are like, well, we are trying to put an organic version of this product together, but we can't meet the same price point.
Mm-hmm.
And that's then, and a lot of these products are things that people on SNAP are eating. right? And so it's like, well, you don't want to take that product out of the line because you also don't want people to be hungry. But you really would only be able to make an organic version for people that were wealthier, which also feels icky. And, you know, at a certain point, I think it still needs to be proven that low-income families are interested in organic and sustainable food. But ultimately, it could all align. If a company sees that that's where they're going to get greater profit, then they're going to want the government to start subsidizing those other ingredients, because right now it's too expensive for them and there aren't enough farmers farming it.
Right.
Yep. Yeah. So hopefully that works out, and we shall see over the next several months.
Yeah.
Hopefully it's all for the best.
Yeah.
So Eve, thank you again very much for calling in this morning. You can follow Eve on Twitter at Eve Turo Paul. Also visit her website at eveturopaul.com. Check out her column on Forbes. Anything else you'd like to plug or say before you go, Eve?
I don't think so. I think you covered it. Thanks so much.
All right. Excellent.
Thank you so much calling in.
Have a good weekend.
Of course. Have a good one, guys.
Bye. Bye.
All right. Awesome. So that wraps up our interview with Eve Turo Paul. Very happy that we finally got that to happen. So we're going to take our song break now, and then we will be back to wrap up. So you are listening to An Unbalanced Breakfast here on WMFO Medford 91.5 FM, streaming live on WMFO.org. I'm going to go ahead with my song choice first, which I actually switched up in the middle of that interview. Going to the Blink 182 concert next weekend, and A Day to Remember is playing with them. A Day to Remember is not playing this song, but it is fitting because it's a Saturday morning. It's called Another Song About the Weekend off of Homesick, and you're hearing it on An Unbalanced Breakfast.
not you, it's me, your heart. Listen to me. We've got to talk. High blood pressure is serious, and yours? Whoa. What happened to us? We used to be so much more active. But lately, you've been ignoring me. I know you think I'm just gonna keep ticking away forever, but you're wrong. You can do so much more to control your high blood pressure. Doing the minimum isn't doing enough. I'm under a lot of pressure and can quit whenever I want. Bet you didn't know that. But I like my job. Just treat me better. Check on me. Give me something green to nibble on every once in a while. And maybe we can do some exercise on occasion. Let's get to it. After all, we're in this together.
Listen to your heart. Don't let it quit on you. High blood pressure can lead to a stroke, heart attack, or death. Get your blood pressure to a healthy range before it's too late. Find out how at heart.org/bloodpressure. Check, change, control. A message from the American Heart Association, the American Stroke Association, and the Ad Council.
Let your dreams come to life in a dark.
Welcome back to An Unbalanced Breakfast here on WMFO Medford 91.5 FM, streaming live on WMFO.org. That worked out well because Kathleen was going to suggest playing what you just heard. That was Bored to Death, one of the most recent singles from Blink 182 for their big comeback album. Before that, we had another song about The Weeknd from A Day to Remember, those two bands on tour currently, and they'll be playing in Mansfield next Friday night.
Mansfield? My husband works in Mansfield, so I know where that is.
Yeah, I know. It's just funny because it's like you're from Michigan before coming here, right? And then you know what Mansfield is and what Norwood is, and it's a very interesting experience for you because that's not what a typical transplant would.
Right, no.
All right, so we have a little less than 10 minutes here on the show. If you want to call in, numbers here are 855-915-WMFO. That's 855-915-9636 or 781-350-3264. And we just had a follow-up or two from our interview with Eve Turo-Paul that took up the bulk of the show this morning. Again, very happy to finally be able to talk to her on the show.
Yes.
And Kathleen, I know you wanted to touch on something that she had brought up.
So one thing that she said kind of on her way out that we didn't really get to talk about was... she said it's like it remains to be seen whether SNAP recipients or low-income individuals, whether there's a demand there for farmers market produce and like organics and things. And interestingly, for my internship, I did a bunch of research on small farms in New England and how they're good for New Englanders. And one of the sections of the paper I talk about food access a little bit. And there was a 2013 study that looked at food spending, SNAP spending at farmers markets. And between 2009 and 2012, spending grew from a little over $4 million to like well over $16 million. So like a fourfold increase of SNAP spending at farmers markets, which I'm sure has something to do with the double bucks,
the matching,
incentivization and things like that, but also shows that people are spending their money there. So that's a good thing. But more recently, Massachusetts is actually pioneering, it's called the Healthy Incentives Pilot Program. I don't know if they're calling it a pilot still or if it's a full-blown program, but they got some money to establish automatic payments that would go directly to farmers to enroll SNAP recipients in CSA subscriptions. So there are currently 27 farms in Massachusetts that are participating in this program. And it's seen a lot of good success. And the automatic payment system eliminates some of the logistical hurdles that the state was encountering in getting people to sign up. It was a matter of like having to go to a specific place, and I don't know. But it also eliminates any possible stigma that people have around SNAP, where it would require people to like have their card out at a farmer's market or something. This happens entirely automatically, and no one needs to know that like you're paying for your CSA subscription with SNAP, because it's all happening in the background. So that's kind of a really cool incentive that Massachusetts is pioneering. It's the first of its kind in the country, and I think it's meant to serve as a model for other states to take on.
That's great too, and because the other side of that is it's not always simple for the farmers market themselves to implement that too. It's always a big thing. If you're familiar with ever looking for internships or jobs at farmers markets, a lot of times one of the key descriptions or key projects they're always working on is implementing those matching programs and the system for that. So it's good to see that it's taking off and successful. Actually, it's funny too, because Eve had mentioned Sweetgreen as something that's come out of the food movement as a nice place to go for organic food food waste. Shouldn't call it necessarily food waste in this case, but kind of repurposed food. So ironically, Sweetgreen in Back Bay is currently closed due to 20 health violations that were found.
Yes, which I've eaten there, and that like alarms me little bit.
Yeah, so that's always fun. It's always kind of like one of those things where it's like, you know, one step forward, two steps back. It's like, we have Sweetgreen that are doing this great thing, and it's like, oh, and now they're the ones being closed. Of all places, Chipotle and Sweetgreen are the ones that are getting nailed with health violations right now.
Yeah. I wonder if Sweetgreen will send out coupons to tip to like everybody. We got Chipotle coupons in the mail when they were kind of trying to make a comeback
and they're currently doing a gift, not gift card, like finally doing like a customer loyalty program right now too.
Yeah.
Chipotle. But yeah, this is the fourth time that Sweet Green has failed an inspection by the city of Boston. So.
Oh, it's the fourth time.
That is something to keep an eye on.
Wow.
There's no word yet, or at least as of when this article is published, no word when the restaurant will reopen. And so then with Goldman's left here, just want to bring up a couple other headlines. There's an interesting piece. You have to take it for what it's worth. It was published in the National Review, which is a renowned conservative publication, but it's a 10-year follow-up after 10 years to the Omnivore's Dilemma and Michael Pollan and the impact he's had. It's, as you would expect, relatively one-sided. So definitely check out. I would recommend checking out the piece because there's definitely some legitimate points. It's written by, I believe, a farmer. So from his perspective and point of view. And I think that it gets to, even though it's a specific perspective, it kind of gets to what we were touching on with Eve in terms of what the food movement is doing, what the different sides are and how they're reacting, and what the actual real world impact has been by this change in, or the desire for people to change their eating habits and the food that they're eating. All right. Anything else you wanted to touch on before we wrap up here?
I'm good. We should probably talk about...
Yep, I wanted to leave a couple of minutes. So this is going to, we're going to be, again, temporarily signing off after this show. Both of us are out in 2 weeks anyway. And then the future of the show is kind of a little bit up in the air right now. But Kathleen will hopefully definitely be back in some point. Hopefully the same time slot if it all works out. But we'll be going through the schedule changeover here in WMFO in the next month or so. So as usual, as we always say, stay tuned on Facebook. You can follow us on Balanced Breakfast Radio.
We're calling it a temporary hiatus.
Yes, temporary hiatus. It's not the...
Even though we don't have firm plans for when the hiatus will end.
Right, and same, I mean, this is what it was like with Catherine as well, where we were like, oh, Catherine's leaving for sure, but the show will be back at some point. We had a nice little summer run of 4 or 5 episodes. And thank you for coming on as co-host.
Yeah, well, I love this, and so thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, so it's been good, and again, so stay tuned. We'll be announcing when the show relaunches. As always, check us out, again, as I said, on Facebook and also SoundCloud as well. You can download, at least as of today, all episodes that we've done. This episode will be up hopefully within the week. You can check out the interview with Eve in case you missed that. But until then, until next time, so we're going to sign off as we always do. Everyone have a great weekend, and we, or at least Kathleen for sure, will be talking to you in the near future.
Yep.
See ya.
Bye.
It takes a lot to make a stew.
A pinch of salt and laughter too.
A scoop of kids to add the spice.
A dash of love to make it nice. And you got
too many cooks.
Too many cooks.
Too many cooks. Soup.
Everyone adds an extra scoop.
Mix an ounce of a smile so sweet.
A dash of cool to add the heat. And you've got
too many cooks.